they told me that no one else survived. And from that moment on, I had to ask continuously, why? And it was immensely troubling. And as I've talked to soldiers that have been coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan about this same issue, it affects them as well when their group is hurt, and they say, why not me? Why didn't it happen to me? But then I don't know the right answer to how you heal the brain, but it's definitely slower than the physical side.
Was the memorial service a helpful experience for you?
It was exhausting for me mentally and physically. My arms still barely worked, but everyone from the town and everyone at the air station and everyone that had come to the memorial service was hugging me, and I couldn't be limp and not hug back. So I was hugging as many people that would hug me. I would hug back, and I was exhausting. Mentally, I think I was more of a robot. I didn't know how much I was supposed to cry. I didn't know if I was supposed to cry. I mean, not crying would be seen as that I was too stern, and it was very difficult mentally, because obviously all I wanted to do was curl up into a ball and cry that Sean specifically wasn't there anymore. I'd known him since 99. I'd known him since I showed up at the academy. I'd known him most of my adult life, and to have him be the one that I was flying with that didn't come up to the surface was very trying. And then the amount that I'd known about Adam and Brett, just having met them, about their families and about their struggles, their hardships, and the things that they love, I had to be there to memorialize them, but it was very hard. It was hard, but it was needed. It needed to happen.
Do you keep in touch with any of the families today?
Absolutely. I attempt to talk to them as often as I can without being bothersome. And more than anything, it's for me. I feel like I want to know how their life's going. How are the children, the seven children that are left behind, how are they doing? Is there anything I can do to help?
When you found out there were charges, how did you find out?
It was a slow process. I was 6 days from starting flying again in Mobile, Alabama. I was actually in Washington, D.C. My wife, Ellen, had loaded up our two children at the time, packed everything up, and was going to fly down to Pensacola to stay with friends and in Mobile to stay with friends while I went through the requalification course. We had plans. We had plane tickets. And then I was told there while I was in D.C. that I couldn't attend the training.
How were you ultimately informed of the charges? Do you get called into an office, or what happens?
I was sitting there, and I got a phone call from now Captain Cameron telling me to come back to the office. And I said, sir, I'm at the health fair. Can I wait until noon? He said, no, come back right now.
The air station's commanding officer informed Leone of the charges. Destruction of government property for the loss of the helicopter, neglecting his duties as navigator by not avoiding the wires, and the military equivalent of negligent homicide for the deaths of the two crewmen aboard, Hoke and Banks.
I had formally been read those exact same charges during the admin investigation, but promised that they were just normal. You know, we have to always read you your rights before doing an investigation. So I'd seen those charges before. I'd seen the negligent homicide. I'd seen the dereliction of duty. But to now see it actually charged against me, all I could do was sit with my lower jaw gasping.
This is in then Commander Cameron's office?
Correct. And I asked him, what's next? What do we do next? And he said, well, because of the severity of the charges, you'll be taken to a Article 32. And he was extremely professional.
An Article 32 hearing is similar to a grand jury proceeding in civilian court. A military evaluator hears evidence and decides whether there's merit to proceed to a court-martial. Leone's hearing took place in Juneau in December. The Coast Guard said the helicopter was going too fast and that Leone fell short of his duties as navigator. Leone's attorneys argued the Coast Guard should have already removed the wires the chopper hit because they had been implicated in two other accidents. As the arguments went back and forth, Leone sat inside the courtroom and listened. But outside the courtroom, he tried not to think about it.
My family is unbelievable. My wife, my dad, my mom, stepmother, all my family, and then the Sitka family that came over on the ferry with me. How did I occupy my time without the trial is not talking about the trial. The first day of testimony was just so incredibly trying on my soul, being told of every single thing that I did wrong.
The Coast Guard dropped all charges against Leone, but issued what's called a final action memorandum on the accident. It said Leone directly contributed to the deaths of those on board, and it said he should have been more vocal in challenging Kruger, the pilot in command, when he made a low pass over the Coast Guard boat below. In a memo of his own, Leone says the black box voice recordings from the accident don't tell the whole story, and that he did challenge Kruger, using a method taught to him by the Coast Guard. He calls it floating a trial balloon.
You say things like, we might not have much radio communications this low, or there sure is a lot of bald eagles or birds down this low. You say stuff like that so that they pick up on your discomfort, but you allow them to then make a decision without you having to challenge their authority for the sole purpose of saying that you're uncomfortable. Because truth be told, when I first showed up in Sitka, I was very uncomfortable because it was different. I'd never flown below terrain. And that's something that I believe anyone that shows up in Alaska that flies below mountain ridges when you can't even see the top of the mountain, it's very different than any flying that I'd done before. So I'd use this the whole time I've been at Sitka for those first couple weeks to gently say I was uncomfortable without being the outcast of, oh, this guy's never going to be able to be an aircraft commander. He's afraid when we even fly through Whale Bay, Gut Bay. Instead of being afraid and being concerned openly, I say, wow, how would we turn around if we had a problem here? It's floating a trial balloon that would get across the point that I'm uncomfortable, but I don't want to challenge the authority of the aircraft commander.
Okay, it's kind of like, boy, we're going really fast. When you're in a car.
Yeah, yeah. Or like, I hope there's not any cops around. It would be that type of stuff. Like that's what yes, you got it. Boy, we're going pretty fast. Wow, I didn't know the car could go this fast. Instead of saying, slow down, you incompetent driver, I'm going to drive. That's the spectrum that clear, bold, and concise can take, you know?
With the Coast Guard's report came an admonishment from Rear Admiral Thomas Ostebo, the Coast Guard's commander in Alaska. Leone was transferred to a desk job in San Antonio, Texas. He's now a Coast Guard liaison to TRICARE, the military's health insurance arm, and he's awaiting word about promotion. His lawyer, John Smith, says the promotion is facing extra, unnecessary scrutiny. A Coast Guard board met this month and made a recommendation. That stays secret and heads to Admiral Robert Papp, the Coast Guard's commandant, in Washington, D.C.
They will decide the fate of my, really fate of my Coast Guard career, fate of me flying again. After the second AEB met and said I could fly again, I really didn't think there was a way to not fly again. But then I started realizing that if I didn't make lieutenant commander, I would see out the rest of my time in the Coast Guard here in San Antonio.
If Papp allows the promotion to move ahead, Leone will become a lieutenant commander and receive back pay to August 1st, the date the promotion was scheduled to take effect. If Papp takes Leone off the promotion list, the matter moves to the desk of Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano. How has everything that's happened, I mean, from July 7th up until this current situation, how has this shaped the way you feel about the Coast Guard?
The Coast Guard is a great organization. It has developed me from when I was 17 to where I currently am. And this has really shown me and developed me, I think, more than if I had had nothing happen to me. It has developed my character. It has developed my knowledge of truth. It has developed how I deal with people. And it has really humbled me to how little I really control a lot of things in my life. But it's not changed my opinion of the Coast Guard. It's a wonderful organization filled with the best that America has to offer.
I think people hear that and think, how can he still like the Coast Guard after all of this?
The amazing part is it's not the entire Coast Guard. I have gotten so much more support than any of the negative stuff. And it's a question that's hard for me to answer. I'm not one that gives up. I will continue pressing for what I believe is right, and I will not compromise my honor, respect, or devotion to duty like I've been taught. I will do what I believe is right for the Coast Guard, and I believe what's right is for me to go through this and see the process to finality.